My name is Greg Mancios. I am the director of the City University of New York's Murphy Institute for Labor Studies and Worker Education. I want to thank the four candidates for being with us today and agreeing to participate in this debate. I want to welcome each of them, and I want to welcome the members of Local 100 and the members of the press to our institute here. Tonight's event is co-sponsored by the institute along with Cornell University's labor programs. We are especially pleased to be hosting this debate tonight for two reasons. One, this is a great union with a great history. Secondly, this is democracy at work. We are going to be witnessing the clashing of ideas, of visions, and of opinions. I don't want to take any more time than is necessary at the mic because we have four candidates sitting up here who are very eager to have you hear what they have to say. And I see a lot of members out here who are equally anxious to hear them speak. So before anybody brings out the hook, I'm going to get down to the business of introducing our moderator tonight. He's a great trade unionist and educator par excellence, a terrific organizer, our colleague and dear friend from Cornell, Gene Carroll. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg, and good evening, everyone. A moment of appreciation before we begin. Appreciation to Greg and his staff, and in particular Jeanette Gabriel, my colleague. Jeanette and I have done a lot of the legwork putting this together, and she's been fantastic. And Greg and his staff and presenting this debate in their facility. Much appreciation and really a giant thank you. Appreciation also to the four campaigns who are represented here tonight. I moderated a conference call with four representatives of one from each campaign last week, where we agreed to the ground rules for this event this evening. There was cooperation, there was agreement, and the procedures that we're following tonight, the opening and closing statement, the timing, the security team that we formed has all been done among the four campaigns cooperatively. I also want to mention just for a second, because many people in the news media have called me and have bugged me about this, and I'm just going to say this straight about the Barry Roberts issue. This is Mr. Roberts was informed about this debate. He was invited to this debate. He spoke directly to my colleague Jeanette Gabriel about this debate. He chose not to participate in the debate. He knew the deadlines and the procedures. That's all I have to say. I draw no conclusion. So tonight we engage in a form of democracy, and the real purpose of this event is not only for the people in this room and for the candidates to get their positions known and sharpened, but really also because we have many members of the news media here. This is an opportunity for the citizens of New York to hear about the positions and the concerns of the four of the camps in this important debate. Because TWU Local 100 is an integral part of the history and life and economy of this city, we know that whoever is the leader of that union is an important player in the life of this city. It's a position of enormous responsibility, significant visibility, and we felt at Cornell and at the Murphy Labor Institute that this form of democracy, which the labor movement does not do enough of, needs to be put forth in a visible way, and that's why we put this together. And it's another reason for me to commend the four campaigns represented here tonight, because this is a form of democracy. The ground rules, they're quite simple. First of all, each speaker will be given an opportunity for an opening and a closing statement, 3 minutes in length. We have a timekeeper sitting right here, and she will designate when there's 60 seconds remaining and when there's 30 seconds remaining, and we will proceed from that. Then I will ask the questions to the candidates, and they have 2 minutes to answer the question. They can answer it in 30 seconds or 2 seconds, but they have 2 minutes maximum to answer the question. The candidates are to ask to talk directly to the group, and there's going to be no asking the questions of each other. They may do that rhetorically, but the other party is not to respond. I'm going to ask the questions and moderate the debate in that fashion. Also, the security team, part of the ground rules is that Each campaign has designated one person to form a security team. We have a security team of four people in this room. In the event that someone is disruptive, and I, as the moderator, determine that they need to be removed from the room so that the process can go forward unfettered, so democracy can be carried forth in an open and fair and equitable manner, that security team will act to remove that person. And in any other thing I need them to do, and if they disagree with any of my decisions, we all agreed that they'll knock my head after the meeting is over with, so we can proceed. So, actually, I don't know the... We pick names out of the hat. We pick numbers out. Who goes first? Okay, Mr. Toussaint, who's second? Okay, Mike, third? Anthony and Mr. Okay, so what we're going to do is proceed with the opening statement of Mr. Toussaint. And thank you all for being here.
Hi, good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone and congratulate the candidates for the courage of being up here to face transit workers and answer questions. Let me begin by pointing out, when Chairman Calico entered the hotel room at the 11th hour, 1 hour before contract deadline, the MTA's intention was to force transit workers to accept a bare-bones contract, and they didn't believe that we would have the wherewithal to pull the plug and stand up for our members. We had told them that this contract could not be settled as a bare-bones contract, that we needed a pension refund, that we needed retiree medical, that we needed paid maternity and paternity leave, that we needed to close the gap between what our maintainers are paid on the inside and prevailing wage on the outside. We needed paid schooling and all of these items that were critical for the benefits package of transit workers. It took a tough decision, a tough call to stay the course rather than buckle and fold and accept Chairman Calico's bare bones contract, which incidentally also excluded Martin Luther King Day as the new holiday. That's what this union requires, tough leadership. You cannot give a union like ours over to weak leadership because we're up against very bad people. From day one, my administration has been about answering the calls and challenges facing transit workers. Back in 2001, we had a bankrupted health benefits fund. We fixed that. We came out of the 2002 contract with a guaranteed benefit plan. We led a strike out in Liberty that greatly improved the health benefits of our private line members out there and raised the barrier for retirement up to $105 times years of service. We found a humongous disciplinary problem and safety problem. And the 2002 contract, we made major headway fixing the disciplinary problem and the safety problem. That, again, all of these things have required tough leadership, always answering challenges. On our website, at rt2006.org, we list the accomplishments of my administration. Not one or two, not four or five, but over 100 accomplishments of our administration. Major accomplishments and moderate accomplishments in the area of economic benefits for members, union reform and democracy, membership participation, communication, mobilization. Our entire operation has been a mobilizing machine, bringing the union back to the members of Local 100. Thank you.
Good evening. I'd like to thank Jeanette Gabrielle and Jean Carroll for putting this event together. I'd like to start off with a statement made by our founding father, Mike Quill. We were no experts in the field of labor organization, but we had something in common with our fellow workers. We were all poor. We were all overworked. We were all victims of an 84-hour work week. In fact, we were so low down on the economic and social ladder, we had nowhere to go but up. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that fact still holds true today. Now, mind you, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that the current leadership was all that bad. They've made some changes in our policy structures within Local 100, and I commend that administration for that. But they lacked in the area that really affects our membership, and that is our members work hours upon hours just to make ends meet. Our wage increases have been below the cost of living. Our members donate their time to this job, away from their families and their loved ones. That has got to change. Discipline rules have been modified, but not enough. Discipline is an epidemic with the Transit Authority. There's been no negotiations regarding our night differential. The last time our night differential was negotiated was in 1988. And then again in 1996, under then-President Willie James, who opened up the Memorandum of Understanding, he reopened the contract in 96, and he gave away our night differential on overtime. That, to this day, has not been renegotiated. We also have problems in our private lines, bus companies. Roger talks about a strike back in 2002 with the private lines. The members were out for 7 weeks without pay. They suffered for that. Again in 2005, during our contract negotiations, the private lines went out on strike for us, which had really no effect on the city. I mind you, a deadline is a deadline, and we did not strike on that deadline. We held off. It was a sign of retreat, defeat, and stagnation. That is a problem for Local 100 members. We are looked upon in the public arena as weak, and that has got to change. Thank you very much.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Anthony Staley, and I'm a cleaner with the New York City Transit Authority. I have 13 years of service. I'm currently the chairman of the board for the Nubian Society, which is a fraternal organization within the Transit Authority, as well as served as vice president of the Parents Teachers Association in my school district. My reason for being here and choosing to be a candidate is because the members over the years has been neglected by the current administration and over the two terms that existed. And I'm here for the members to make changes. Whatever's benefits and that's beneficial to the members is this what I'm after. And I feel that the current administration has done really nothing. The claims of whatever they claim they're supposed to have done, I'm on the road. I see what's done. I see what happens to the members on this job, and I'm looking to make changes for the better.
Hi, good evening, everyone. My name is Angie Stewart, plant maintenance mechanic of the New York City Transit Authority. For the most part, this election comes down to delivery of service to our membership, whether there was a failure, whether there was a breakdown, and it's quite evident. It's evident in the last two contracts, or I should say Roger Toussaint's first two contracts. In 2002, he got us a 0-3-3. In 2005, he got us 3%, give back 1.5% at a time the Transit Authority has money coming in like waves on the seashore. You'll never see money like this again in the Transit Authority. If you can't score now, you'll never score. Going back to 2002, not only did we get a 0-3-3, Toussaint also agreed with the Transit Authority to write us up whenever we use our sick time, even if we have doctor's lines. At a time, he accused the Transit Authority of plantation justice. He was aiding the enemy with a new and a more aggressive path towards terminating our members when you use those 12 days that they give you. Now, here we are in 2005. He more or less campaigned and he yelled, no contract, no work. Not only did he more or less went out on strike and brought us back without a contract, he entered into a lot of secret deals that we still don't even know the number. And they're coming out from day to day. But at the ending of the day, what's important here is the absence of the delivery of service for transit workers. The contract before the strike was worth $477 million. The contract after the strike was worth only $400 million. I mean, Willie James's contract of 1999 was worth $550 million. Toussaint took us backward both in 2002 and 2005. And I say the transit workers, you elect me, Ainsley Stewart will stand out there on the front line, more or less defending your interests, looking to promote and demand that we get better wages, better health care, better working conditions, and a better pension plan. I stood there and says, vote against the 1.5% give back, and the members recognized what it was worth to them, and they rejected the contract. And I also said 10, 10, and 10, because that's the way to start when you have $1 billion, and no one took that position. And I think with the courage that I've demonstrated, I'm much more qualified for the job than anyone else here today. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, here's the first question. Just so you know, I gave each of the four candidates the first question 10 minutes ago, because, you know, I'm in the spirit of trying to get people loosened up and ready to go. You know, we're not here to, like, play a game. We're here to be serious. This is the first question. The purpose of this first question is to learn from each of you something about who you are. Who and what are the major influences that have shaped your worldview and your values? Now, I'm asking this question because we're talking about people who would assume the position of president of Local 100 of the Transport Workers Union in the city of New York with 34,000 members and the enormous responsibilities that entails. In other words, how and why did you become an activist in Local 100? What does the labor movement mean to you? What are your experiences? What is the knowledge that you possess? And what are the values you believe in that qualifies you to be president of TWU Local 100?
I have been politically active, or my conscious political life goes back to 1968. So that would make it 38 years, I'm sorry. Math was not my best subject. I'm a product of the social movements that swept the Caribbean, Latin America, and America in the late 1960s and the early 1970s. That's the anti-war movement, the black people's struggle in America, the fights that were taking place across Africa and Latin America. So from a very early age, I was instilled with a sense of social consciousness and obligation to the brotherhood and sisterhood of humanity. So I think that has guided has been my guiding motivation when I came to New York, and my life as a transit worker and my participation in Transport Workers Union Local 100. Every time there's a problem, I go back to my center, which is to stand for unity of working men and women and to oppose division and tribalism based on interests that are other than the interests of the working class. So, for instance, I have conducted an unrelenting fight against sexism inside of this union, and I would not support a slave that couldn't find a woman to put in the top 10 or on the top executive board of this union. I fought against divisions between subways and buses, private lines and the MTA, between men and women, between skilled trades and unskilled trades, and so forth. So I have been unrelenting in trying to eliminate second-class citizenship, and previously neglected sectors of our union have been brought to the fore of the union, including our retirees, our women, or private line members, for instance, who were never even on the map before and now on the map, and so forth.
Well, that was impressive. I haven't been political active in my community and whatnot like that, but I started my career back in 1989 as a transit conductor. About a year and a half into my career, I was disciplined, and I went to my union for help. Now, mind you, I was married with a child, needed the job during the holidays. I was about to lose my job. I was suspended without pay. And at that point, I realized that my union wasn't there for me. The union officers at the time were telling me, take the penalty. We'll get your time served. We'll do this. We'll do that. If you go in front of an arbitrator, you're going to lose your job. Well, I knew right then and there, if I was able to save my own job, I would definitely run for union office to help other brothers and sisters that have faced the same problems. Well, needless to say, almost 18 years later, I'm still here, and I'm ready and willing. Been elected division chairman for 6 years, 1998 to 2004. Prior to that, I was a shop steward and safety rep. My views in regards to labor in this country, I think they haven't done enough for the little man and woman. I think they lack regarding health and safety, regarding OSHA, PESH, and so on and so forth, and most definitely our union lacks in that. I thank you.
As far as why I became an activist, because after a certain length of time on this job, I was seeing how the members on the job were being treated. And they were really being fairly represented by the union. The union really never took a real strong position to defend the members. And I felt that if you were paying dues, you should be treated better and defended better than we were being treated. And that's the one thing that I say about the current administration. The problem is that even now with discipline, management is running amok through the system, disciplining us, and not only that, we have to pay when we lose at our hearings. And people are losing pay, hard-earned pay, because of a decision made in the previous contract. And management is taking advantage of that. That's why they're writing up people at the rate they're doing. And they have bad representation. We deserve better representation. One of the things that I would do is have trained reps to represent people at their hearings. And number two, I would also speak with management about the way they allow their supervisors to treat the members and allow them to put the supervisors on the spot for those that do frivolous write-ups and those that harass members on the job. Make them answer to them as well.
I would say that more or less feel-good speeches at this juncture here from the incumbent is more or less, it's a waste of time. You've had two opportunities, and you've repeatedly failed. You've been given much more than any reasonable person would give to you. Two failed contracts, transit workers can't afford to more or less risk you for a third contract. Regarding why I got involved in union business, as a matter of fact, my struggle started back in about 29 years ago, and I can remember there was a mechanical engineer by the name of Donald Dundas. I was a mechanic helper, and he came into the workshop and said to me, "Angeli, why don't you sweep around the workshop a little? There's a lot of paper around the place." And I said, "Mr. Dundas, why don't you get it? We have a title by the name of cleaner. Why would you ask me to do that?" Okay, and from that day onward, I was labeled as a troublemaker, as one who doesn't want to cooperate with management, et cetera, et cetera. And coming to the Transit Authority, actually, I couldn't understand why the contract would say one thing, but then in practice, it's something completely different. And that got me involved to such an extent that I almost got fired. Okay, and one of the ironic things I can tell you today is that both Toussaint and I ended up at 59th Street, Columbus, 59th Street, 59th Street, getting fired before the arbitrator, facing termination charges. But the bottom line, delivery is what's important. My thing here, I believe that a fair day's work requires a fair day's pay. Okay, I believe it's a human right to be able to go out there and work and get livable wages. I believe that once the Transit Authority has money, transit workers must get their fair share. The cost of living is through the roof. Gas is through the roof. And what's happening for the most part is the representation that we have here is more concerned with giving back to the Transit Authority rather than demanding more for the workers so we can keep up with cost of living and take care of our families rather than considering getting a second job to supplement where the union has failed. Thank you.
Thank you. The second question, if you need me to repeat it, I'd be happy to. The Transit Authority has a widespread reputation as a tough employer. The large number of discipline charges and grievances filed reflects a working environment that is riddled with animosity, a situation that can contribute to an unsafe, unhealthy, stressful, and inefficient workplace for rank-and-file members of Local 100. And these conditions are also not in the best interest of the riding public and taxpayers. What should the union do about it?
I don't think anyone has been tougher than my administration in taking on the MTA in this whole area. When we came on, there were thousands of disciplinary actions a year, and there continues to be thousands of disciplinary actions, and there's a lot of work to be done in this area. But here's a number of things that has occurred. For one thing, we have eliminated, for 70% of our members, that's 23,000 members, the notion of being under house arrest when you're out sick. This generated probably the most disciplines, or one of the largest categories of disciplines in the system. So our members no longer require to stay at home when they're out sick. We eliminated disciplinary charges for preventable accidents on the property, which accounts for thousands of accidents for bus operators every year. In the current contract, we have an agreement for a systemic reduction in discipline, because what we said to them is, we have negotiated for a reduction of discipline, and where we have clamped down in one area, they have found other ways to write our members up at. So therefore, the measure of progress has to be that there has to be a systemic reduction, so there's no explanation or justification. As long as the volume is high, there's a problem. And we have gotten a commitment at that level from them on this. At the end of the day, the way to handle Transit Authority out-of-control discipline is to have a strong union on the job. A strong union, strong policing, enforcement of the contract, that's the way that you push back against management. You do need contract language and protections, but without enforcement and policing on the job, the contract language means nothing. There are many departments in which the officers fail to actually carry out and implement the provisions of the contract in order to politically blame the union hall or the headquarters, fail to take advantage of provisions in the contract so they can point fingers and be irresponsible. No. Okay, thank you.
Well, Roger mentioned about the 2002 contract where provisions were made in the contract regarding members not having to call in and out of the house. My take of that is, was he sold 30% of our membership to management. 70% of the membership, yes, we agree, that they stay out of trouble. 30% have some personal difficulties, whatnot. But in that contract, 30% of them were sold down the river, and they have to be placed under house arrest in accordance with our contract. How do we change this? Yes, I would agree. Union reps have to be on the shop floor. But I also would say that the educational process for each and every member, contracts over the years have not been handed out to our membership. Our current bylaws have never been handed out to our membership. Just recently, we just received a full contract. Okay? Our membership is not educated in the sense where they know how to stay out of trouble and what the contract, how the contract protects them. We need more union representation in the field, but we definitely need a better shop stewards program, a better educated shop stewards program in order to fight management on the discipline end of the house. Thank you.
As far as dealing with the MTA, as you know, as I mean, you probably can pick up, this is the first time I'm in a forum like this, so I'm trying to adjust here. So I want to be more comfortable up here. But I want you to understand that under the current process in which we're under for the last two administrations under the president, this discipline has gotten worse. There's nothing has been done basically to stop PA from basically doing what they want. They continuously write people up. People, if you walk through the system, that's the best way to get your gauge on what's going on in the system. Walk through the system and ask some of the people that are actually doing the work instead of somebody sitting here and thinking, he lost touch with this membership. He don't know what's going on within the system. He don't even walk through it. So he has no idea. So he's going to sit there and claim one thing when it's another. And I'm in it, and I see it every day. I help people. A lot of people come to me. I help people independently. Okay? At one point, I was representing members until somebody sent a letter to Labor Relations stating that I was no longer a shop steward, and I wasn't allowed to represent members. Okay? So that's how bad it is. Okay? So... as far as being tough with TA, TA wants somebody to be intelligent enough to challenge them. We don't have nobody intelligent enough to challenge them and make them, you know, go by the contract, stick to the rules. Nobody's strong enough to do that. And that's why the members are suffering now. Because of incompetence within the union, that's why we're suffering. They, to show you how much respect management got for this union, they're running through this system doing whatever they want, writing people up any way and every way they want. We got bad representation downtown, and all it leads to is kickbacks.
Regarding the issue of discipline, the incumbent president has talked loud but aided the transit authority significantly. And I say that to say that in 2002, he agreed with the transit authority to write us up, like I said before, whenever we use those 12 allotted sick days. That was treason against the working class. He also placed in the contract language that says that we must pay for the time spent doing disciplinary hearing. That also was another treasonable act in the sense that it deterred members from more or less going up against the transit authority, going to the end of the case, but instead copping a plea. Okay, and that's why the number of write-ups actually went up. But short of eliminating the progressive disciplinary system, what we need to do, and that hasn't been done in the past, is to ensure that members receive representation from the reps they elect, and that those reps are educated, that they're schooled properly in how to handle the grievance and disciplinary cases when it's presented to them, rather than the president appointing people and assigning them to do those hearings, which is a gross misrepresentation of the membership. Okay, and that's where the major problem is. And I say, if I were to be elected as the president, every member within the union will have an opportunity to not only learn about a contract, but the elected reps will also be schooled significantly. We will take them to training whereby they'll probably spend 3 to 6 months learning every word in the contract. They'll have access to all of the resources within the union, which cases we've won, why we won them, why we lost them, and how we could move forward towards winning them in future. Okay, and we'll ensure that the members' voice is heard.
Thank you. Thank you all for being so disciplined. The next question is this, and actually since we're about halfway through the program, what I was going to recommend was, let's see, we had 1, 2, 3, 4, and why don't we just reverse the order, 4, 3, 2, 1, you want to do that? Everybody comfortable with that? Just to kind of mix it up a little bit. Okay? Is that okay? Okay. All right. Okay, here's the next question. If you want me to repeat it, I'll repeat it. The recent indictment of New York City Central Labor Council President Brian McLaughlin on embezzlement and racketeering charges is damaging to the credibility and moral authority of the entire labor movement. Contrasting this repugnant and despicable situation is the historic reputation of the TWU Local 100 in the public eye as an organization that stands up for workers' interests in New York City, even if you disagree with how this has been done, whether it's in the current administration or previous. Any president of this union has to wear that historic mantle. What role are you going to play as president of Transit Workers Local 100? What role are you going to play in the larger labor movement, for example, as a member of the New York City Central Labor Council, to represent your members and to promote a positive view of labor consistent with TWU's historic reputation? Okay? Mike? Well, let's see. Who is fourth? Oh, you're fourth. That's right. I'm sorry. Ainsley, you go first. Hang on.
When he said fourth, I believe he meant from here, not number four, because you didn't say that.
I didn't say that.
But then we have to go back to the original format.
Let's go back to the original format. What the heck? Come on. Yeah. Come on, brother.
So I answer the first all the time?
Yeah.
Again, I'd like to thank the candidates for their courage. Let me just say that that with respect to Brian's situation, I hope he, at the end of the day, he's proven to be innocent, and he's entitled to his day in court. And we wish him the best. What we have done inside of our union when we took over. Union officers and staff had unlimited sick time and special pension plans and special health benefit plans that distanced them from the membership. We eliminated the unlimited sick time and made union officers and staff have the same type of sick leave like regular members, meaning 12 sick days a year. We eliminated special health benefits and special pensions. Pensions where people were retiring with lump sum pensions of up to $800,000 in one check from the union hall. So we took practical measures. I also cut my own salary and cut salaries and restart the clock with the salaries of all the officers. The point being, we have taken concrete measures and steps to bring the union officers and staff closer to the members and on the other hand, to take the union to the members, to empower the members more, to multiply the participation of the members more. I believe that at the end of the day, how you assure greater accountability is by having participation of the members and by empowering the members in the union and having some serious reforms in terms of union officers enjoying the benefits that they negotiate from the members rather than being set aside and being treated as a privileged group. At the end of the day, the sources of corruption have to do more with this type of dysfunctional problems inside of the labor movement rather than the individual integrity of individuals inside of the movement.
I like to say, I believe corruption in the labor movement has been going on for many, many years. I don't think any one of us up here is going to be able to stop it solely. But if I'm elected president of this local, first of all, the executive board members that are currently on staff will no longer be. That's a conflict of interest. And if that's a source of corruption within itself. Union is supposed to function within accordance of its executive board as the governing body of the local, not the president, all right? So when we talk about corruption, that is right here. It's in home. It's a house. This is what we are, okay? And empowerment of the membership, yes, I would agree with that. But we have to start at the top, and that's from the president on down. Executive board members can no longer be on staff. Appointed staff members by the president can no longer happen. This should be given to elected officers, elected by their membership, which we were supposed to stand for well over 6 years ago. We never put into play that policy. Thank you.
As a president of this union, I would be willing to work with anybody, any individual, or any group that is basically pro-labor. I honestly believe that people that get up out of their base to come to work should be compensated justly, as well as have decent health benefits. And as far as the last two terms, this union basically regressed. And the bad thing about it is that this is not the most, it's the once formidable union as once was. And that as president, I would make changes in that. I would make this a much stronger union, and I would get more for the workers and make sure they're compensated justly as far as health benefits and as far as being able to work on the job safely. Thank you.
Regarding Brian McLaughlin, I hope that at the end of the day, he is proven innocent of the charges against him. But when it comes to Local 100 and accountability and the absence of transparency, I think that more or less what the president outlined here is really a misrepresentation. The president talked about equal benefits. The president didn't cut people's pay. New direction as a campaign promise prior to being elected to office, we agreed to reduce officers' pay. It wasn't a sole it wasn't an act of the president, okay, that he cut people's pay. In addition to that, the members aren't allowed to cash in vacation time nor safe come time. However, the president took it upon himself to cash in vacation time and to cash in comp time, okay, and that's reported in the LM2 of 2003 and 2004. And that came about at a time when we asked why it is that his pay increase went up by $3,000 in 2003, a year the transit workers did not get any raises. We got a zero. And when we asked, they said he cashed in comp time and unused vacation time. And that's not, the members aren't entitled to that. But the problem is, it's a lack of transparency. The union headquarters was sold, and we've never even seen an ad in the newspaper saying the building was up for sale. We've never even seen an appraisal report. We've not seen a check from the proceeds of the building. So when he talks about transparency, that's the thing that has turned members off, because the members who was required to vote on the sale of the building was not allowed to vote on the sale of the building. Okay, and that's why the members are turned off. And that's the type of corruption within house that must stop. And if it doesn't stop, it will continue to weaken the union, because members are saying, we've paid the mortgage for the building for the last number of years we've worked here, and it's sold, and we've moved from a position of $1 million profits to paying rent of $1.5 million profit, paying rent of $1.5 million, and that must stop.
Watch your wire. Thank you, sir. Okay, my next question. Thank you to all you guys for being so disciplined. We know that the introduction of new technology in the workplace, some of it's inevitable, but we also know that the employer has often used the introduction of new technology in the workplace as a opportunity to hammer the union and hammer the worker. What should be the union's policy on the introduction of new technology in the workplace?
Ideally, this should be an area of cooperation. However, given who the MTA is, they see any issue that arises in this area as an opportunity to do two things. One is to undermine the union, and secondly, to put title against title or worker against worker. So our experience with the Transit Authority has been that this is an area that needs very strict policing. We need a level playing field, because what is closely connected to new technology and the new projects that are coming up is the private contractor activity. And once private contractor activity is involved, there are games being played between managers who move from employment in Transit Authority to employment with these private contractors. So where we have dealt with issues of new technology, we have insisted upon measures being in place to make sure that the changes that are being looked at are good faith changes. Where the impacted groups or members whose titles or jobs or job descriptions might be changing, where they are appropriately compensated in the first place, and secondly, that the changes being recommended make sense and that requires some kind of independent oversight from the outside. These are decisions that should not be left to in-house operation heads in the Transit Authority, but need some outside oversight.
Yes, I would agree. Cooperations between the MTA and the union have to be done. But new technology, we're talking about new technology. In our own collective bargaining agreement, we're giving away jobs, and it's not to new technology, okay? We have broadbanding in our jobs. We have painters being sent out to do masonry work. We have masons painting depots. We have bus drivers that do the same job in the private line buses as the TAOA side of the house, but they're not paid equally. We have mechanics in the private line buses that do the same job as the TAOA side of the house, and they're not paid equally. We have members, bus drivers, that sit on board without driving a bus and get paid $15 and change an hour. And the only time that bus driver makes $20-something dollars an hour is when he gets on his bus. That's a disgrace. But we talk about new technology. Well, new technology, as a union and one of the largest TW locals in this country, we should be fighting our federal government and our state for grant money, for educational and upgrading for all our members. Thank you.
Okay, new technology is inevitable. Okay, when it comes to new technology, I have no problem with it. Long as the current members, it doesn't cause loss of jobs, and management is willing to train the current members on that new technology. Other than that, I don't see it a big issue. We're supposed to have a so-called upgrade program that's supposed to exist now that, as far as I see, hasn't been that great. But basically what it should be doing is, as new technology come in and management inform the union of it, that you should be in agreement where there's definitely no loss of the workforce, but management should be able to train them. Thank you.
Regarding the issue of new technology, I think we need to embrace it and carve out whatever we can get out of it, because technology is here to stay, whether you agree or not. But what we need to do is to try to establish some mechanism to more or less not only get what we agreed to in the contract as it relates to new technology implemented, but to ensure that there's involvement, there's input, that you're kept in the informational loop in each and every department. I represent the department of a lot of skilled workers, okay? And for the most part, we've been kept in the dark. We've been kept in the dark, and up until we change that way of thinking, we're going to always run aground. And the membership is also turned off from the process for the simple reason that the contract of 2002 mandated 90 that each year 90 workers will be trained to upgrade. And we've had only one class with 8 workers being trained. Okay, that's 250, 260-something people did not receive training because the union leadership fell asleep at the wheel. In card equipment, instead of having the new technology title be a promotional title for car inspectors, which I represent, and whom have a wide array of academic qualifications, the leadership of the union gave it to Local 375 DC-37. That, again, was a shot in the arm for our members. Another promotional opportunity we lost. Okay, and you can go on and on. But the bottom line of it is this. Under my leadership, I will ensure not that we only get monies from the Transit Authority. We will have our members in the elected officer, police, everything, so that we could get the best deal.
Okay, next question. And here we go. You ready? Concerns about pensions and health insurance are a major issue for workers and families across the country. Most contract disputes and strikes occur around the fight for decent pensions and health insurance, whether it's here in New York City or California, Oregon, wherever. And, of course, it's a big issue for public sector workers in New York and, of course, a central issue in the contract dispute with the Transit Authority. So here's my question in two parts, and I'm going to urge you to try and answer it in two parts. Number one, how do you assess the pension and health insurance provisions in the contract that union members voted on earlier this year? How do you assess the pension and health insurance provisions in the contract that union members voted on earlier this year? That's number one. And number two, what can the union do in the future, going forward, to relieve the pressure that health insurance costs in particular place on the collective bargaining process? What can the union do in the future to relieve the pressure that health insurance costs in particular place on the collective bargaining process? Okay?
Notwithstanding needed improvements in our health benefits package, meaning higher shelf, higher quality benefits, it is important to note that the Transit Authority packages a defined benefit, health benefit plan for the first time as a result of the 2002 contract, so it's now inoculated from inflation. That's important progress. Of course, our pension plan is already a defined benefit pension plan. We have been moving on the private lines to convert the private lines plan into a guaranteed benefit plan or defined benefit plan there as well, because it has been hemorrhaging very seriously for funds over most of the past 10 years. And that's where we want to end up. So again, notwithstanding needed improvements, we could use improvements in dental, we can use improvements in terms of choice of carriers and providers and so forth, but it is a critical fight going on in the labor movement right now to just hold your ground where you are right now. I am more concerned about the dark clouds that are surrounding the entire labor movement, because to the extent that we are faced or surrounded by an adverse climate nationally, it makes it that much more difficult for us to defend what we got. And I don't expect that it will be easy. I think it will be extremely difficult because of the concessions going on around the country. I think this will be the most defining battle in the labor movement for the next several years ahead. And I can't stand here and promise you what the outcome is going to be, because that outcome is not dictated by TW Local 100. It's dictated by the major events taking place around the country. And all that we can do is stand with the rest of the labor movement and urge that a common line be drawn to defend health benefits and pensions, so that decent jobs in America continue to mean decent jobs that includes guaranteed health benefits and guaranteed pensions.
Well, the pension and health insurance, 1.5 that is still lingering over our heads, I think it was a damn disgrace to all members of Local 100. I don't see any reason why any leader or any administration in this union should ever negotiate a percentage in regards to contributions to our health care cost, when subway supervisors in the same company have a set fee, $6 for individuals, $24 for family. But yet, on the backs of the members of Local 100, they want us to feed the cost of the health coverage. I think it's a disgrace. I think it sends a message to labor as a whole. But yet we stand up here and talk about what we have to do as look as labor, other labor organizations, and what they do. Well, I got news for you. We're being looked upon as a disgrace with that 1.5. Thank you.
On the issue of health benefits, if anything, I thought that if they was going to maintain or at least improve it, if you were going to increase it, we should have better medical and a better prescription plan if they was going to increase it. But with this 1.5, it really doesn't benefit the current membership if you got less than 15 years on the job. If you're going out soon, yes, because this 1.5 is going to help the retirees, not the current members that's on the job. And that's the bad thing about it, because you're separating your members in your union. The word union is supposed to be a group. You're supposed to be together. By separating them, using them, retirees, and making it something attractive to them, okay, and allowing them to have a say in whether or not this goes through or not, is unfair to everybody else that got 5 years or less, even 10 years or less. It's not fair to the workers. But my main point in the whole thing is, even though across the board, health co-pays may be going up, but if you were going to increase it, we should have had a better prescription plan and a better medical plan. Second of all, it's not stipulated. We're to the point where if you work overtime, that 1.5 increases on you. It goes up, and it's not fair. It's like making the people that work overtime pay a penalty for working overtime. It helps. It helps the MTA cut their overtime budgets, that for sure.
As dedicated civil servants, we should not be limited to defined benefits and defined contributions and all that type of stuff. We have no control over the viruses that attack us and the hazards that we're exposed to over the
exposed to on the job over the number of years. Transit should pick up the full bill unconditional, period. We don't make enough money. Okay, that's to say, start with that. However, in the 2002 contract, the union agreed with the Transit Authority, at least we were told by the incumbent president, that the reason for giving up the health benefit trust back to the Transit Authority, where we had the power to veto any changes they wanted to impose, was that they were going to pay for medical benefits in future, all medical costs. We demonstrated in front of 130 Livingston Street, we demonstrated in front of Madison Avenue, and we knew that we were going there because the Transit Authority threatened to cut our medical benefits. Even Jesse Jackson complained about the importance of medical benefits by saying that many of the workers who work in those hospitals don't get the opportunity to use those bedpans and those beds that they make up. But the president of our union, he told us that we were not going to be paying for medical benefits was the reason for giving up the health benefit trust. And come one contract later in 2005, there it is, he's sticking it to us, where he's dictating that we pay 1.5% towards medical benefits. And the 1.5% would have generated $40 million at the Transit Authority. And if you look at the 2002 contract, retirees' medical benefits cost only $10 million. So what happens to the $30 million difference? Naturally, that is what he was using to pay for the other items in the contract that he refers to as new benefits. Common sense. And he said, actually, here that he was not good in math. Well, I can see why. Okay, so, you know, going on further, the point is this. We've got to have a union that you can trust, that will stand up and really defend, in the true sense of the word, the interests of the workers, okay, and to ensure that we do get better wages and better medical benefits, and they're not tied together, period. The contract before the strike didn't require us to pay for medical benefits, and therefore, there's absolutely no reason why we should be stuck with that.
Friends, we are going to, I'm going to go to the last question. And after this, then we'll go to closing statements. So we're going to end around 9 o'clock, which is what we've been asked to do by the folks who are in this building. So here's the last question. We ready? The resolution of the contract dispute is now in the hands of an arbitrator. That is a fact. But looking back, how do you evaluate the union's preparation coming into the expiration of the contract last December? And in a related way, as president, is there anything you would have done differently that can serve as a guidepost for Local 100 members, officers, and staff who will be engaged in preparations for their next contract 2 or 3 or 4 years from now? What would you have done differently and why? How do you evaluate the union's preparation coming into the expiration of the contract last December? As president, is there anything you would have done differently that can serve as a guidepost for Local 100 members, officers, and staff who will be engaged in preparations for the next contract 2 or 3 or 4 years from now? What would you have done differently and why?
I think as a matter of record, we did more preparations in the lead up to this contract deadline than has been done in the history of Local 100. As a historical note, a greater percentage of our members participated in actions and activities in the lead up to this contract than participated in the historic Flint, Michigan sit-down strikes, which only 10% of the members in Flint, Michigan participated in. We had over 11,000 members involved in days of actions, meaning solidarity actions, in the months leading up to the contract deadline. So the preparation, we attempted to telegraph a credible threat to the MTA that we were serious and that we will prepare to go the distance. I think that in the long, looking over the months from December through to date, probably the most important lesson that we have been looking at is how we communicate the provisions of the contract to the members. Clearly, there was weaknesses in that area, and we relied more on written communication than on one-on-one discussions with our members in the crew rooms, lunch rooms, and on the shop. And what we did in the second time we voted on the contract is that we relied more on one-on-one conversations with members, which, of course, is an enormous undertaking because you're talking 35,000 members spread over a very expansive property. So We are very proud of what we did in terms of the lead-up to the contract fight. We believe that we created a whole new generations of leaders, rank-and-file leaders, who took charge of their locations and organized protests and so forth. And one of the reasons, one of the evidence of of what we have unleashed in terms of the rank and file movement among our members is in fact the very intense discussion and debate that is even reflected here today. You would not have seen this type of thing 10 years ago among transit workers. And I believe that this is actually part to the credit of our administration.
I think it was poorly done. My opinion of, if I was president of this local, as soon as one contract expires, another one has to begin. And when I say that, committees need to be impaneled right away, right after the contract is ratified, setting your union up for 3 years down the road, investigating all that's in the MTA's holdings, TA holdings and whatnot. Let's not forget here, the TA's receives monies from literature in regards to movie campaigns, telephones. You have newsstands that pay rent. The MTA has property holdings that they are not renting out. These types of things our union should be investigating with a team of members, officers, and lawyers from right after when the last contract is ratified. And then you'll be prepared for anything. I was there a couple of times for negotiations, and the union has always been on the defensive. Well, I'll tell you right now, it's time that we go on the offense. We need to stop what's been going on in our history of our union. Thank you.
Knowing how hard the last contract was to bargain with TA, I would have never started this so-called little rule that they have 100 days to start before they start negotiating. Knowing how they dealt with how to start something at least 6 to 8 months in advance. Not only that, I would have asked the input of all the department heads, all the vice presidents supposed to have input in this here as well. Ask the problems that they have in their departments and address them all as well. The way this was done and the way this last one was even worse than the previous one. The one that we have stuck in arbitration right now, whatever we're going to end up with is what we're going to have to suck up and accept. And this comes from poor management, period. And it runs through the entire union. The entire union basically ran on incompetence. And we have nobody but really to blame but ourselves in a way because we voted these people in and we should have scrutinized them much more better than that and see how much do they actually really care about the membership. A lot of them are just sitting there thinking this is a summer resort and that's it. But they just lost touch with the membership. That's how bad it is out there. That's why some of them just sit there and twist up and do what you want. But this is the truth. This is what's going on. And you've been in that union hall too much. Too long, and maybe you need to come back to the road to see how people are taking it out here, because y'all are not doing anything for us, not as far as hearings, not as far as representing nobody, and to show you about how management has no respect for near one of these individuals sitting here, because they seen them, they heard them, they couldn't fight Roger, how you going to fight management? You couldn't even straighten out your own departments and your department heads, your vice presidents. If Roger didn't want to cooperate with you, you could have fought for your department yourself because you were elected by your departments to do the job, and you didn't do it. So sit up here and point fingers and all that is a bunch of crock. These guys didn't do nothing.
You know, actually, you know, at this point in time, actually, I've drawn a blank. I'll admit to that. But I'll tell you, essentially what has happened, okay, and why we're in the predicament we're in is that the president, more or less, at every step of the way, at every level, excluded not only the membership, but all of the elected officers. I would agree that there are more members participated, but that's at the street level. But when it came to the issue of negotiating wages, pension, health benefit, everyone was excluded. The president alone did that. And in my administration, that will never happen. Okay? The ability to express different ideas and opinion is the backbone of every union. Okay? And you must have people come to express those different ideas and opinions and then pick up from there and move forward. Okay, and I say that to say to you that what we've experienced essentially is everything being done in the dark. The arbitration process today We've never had one meeting, basically, to discuss what's going on. That's the type of exclusion when you go back into the field and tell the memberships that it irates them. And under my administration, that will never happen also. As a matter of fact, we wouldn't even get to arbitration. We will have a contract on that deadline. And if we say a deadline is a deadline, certainly it would be a deadline. Okay, and there'll be no excuses. We've seen here too many excuses. We've seen here that the contract that we have here was either the MTA was bad, they worked with all of the other persons, but not the people who sat there and reached the agreement taking responsibility for it. And under my administration, I will take responsibility for any and every action that I engaged in. And I would ensure that we, at the end of the day, get the best, okay, that we can get at that bargaining table.
Thank you. Brothers, we are now going to proceed with the closing statements. Timekeeper, each speaker gets 3 minutes, and then we'll come to a close. Okay, and thank all of you. So, first closing statement.
Thank you. As mistaken as I think Brother Seeley is about his conclusions, I think he spoke a bit from his heart in many of his comments here. Again, mistaken. But one comment in particular needs to be underlined. These gentlemen have been officers for the better part of a decade, and they can, and so they're part of the We Hate Roger Club. But for the better part of a decade, they can't point to what their own accomplishments have been. There's no shortage of issues in their departments to fight management on. Before I became a chairman in the track division, I led numerous battles on the tracks over safety, harassment, contract enforcement, and it resulted in me being fired for 2.5 years and going for 2.5 years without a paycheck before I was elected president of the union. I didn't blame Willie James, Sonny Hall, Damaso Seda. I went out there and picked and took a fight to the boss. They have not done that. And so at the end of the day, there's a saying, don't tell me what you believe. Show me what you do, and I will tell you what you believe. These gentlemen cannot show you what they have done except point fingers and throw arrows at me. At the end of the day, the MTA is a bunch of bad people. This job as the president of the union is a very serious, dangerous job, right? When we fight in New York City, we fight against the governor, who is the employer of the MTA. We up against the dailies. We up against Wall Street. We're up against a culture that goes back decades of arrogance, one of the most out-of-control agencies in the state. You need tough leaders with vision and principle who have a record of accomplishments to lead a union such as ours. And we should not hand this union over to people who are good at simply pointing fingers and making accusations, but who cannot point to a single accomplishment in the many years that they have been elected officers in this union, right, who have worked under me. I am a tough leader. I hold myself to tough standards, and I hold people under me to tough standards. And I believe that union officers and staff receive good salaries for the work that they're supposed to do, and our members require them to deliver a work product. If we are going to change the culture in this labor movement, we need tough labor leaders that will hold everyone to principle inside of the labor movement, because this movement has been asleep for too long. And partly because union officers and staff tend to feel that with their election comes some type of entitlement, so they can put their feet up on the desk and enjoy the good life, the life of Riley. Under my administration, you're going to have to get out there and do your work and do your job and make this union stronger and put your shoulders to the wheel. Otherwise, you got to go.
I'd like to clear one thing up. I haven't been in office since 2004. So I had no part of this last disaster, which we'll call a contract. I'd like to ask, the last 6 years since Roger's been president of this local, what is the major victories of legislation? No heart bill, no lung bill, no prior service, no three-quarter disability on our pension. No big progress here. Roger talks about offices, what we have done. Well, I worked under Roger Toussaint, and I said in my opening statement that he did some good in the policy change of the local, and I'll stand to that. But the man put the handcuffs on his officers. He did not allow us to represent our members accordingly. Everything we tried to do, he stopped us. Myself, when the compensation law changed in 2001. That evening, I was in the Union Hall till well past 11 o'clock at night, making up flyers for my membership to inform them of the new compensation laws. The next morning, I was called in to the office and asked why I was doing that. I had no right to do that. That's what I was told. All right? So when we talk about strong leaders, let's really look at the big picture. How strong of a leader that puts handcuffs on its own officers that were duly elected by the membership to serve them accordingly? You cannot serve your membership under Roger Toussaint's administration the way you're supposed to. Thank you very much, and thank you for your time.
Okay, these guys have been in office, and they're talking about how much they've done. Okay, as far as I'm concerned, the last two terms, the last two contracts, this union regressed. We didn't progress anything, so I don't know what they're thinking about. Maybe he progressed as far as his self-concern, but not this membership nor the union. And in closing, I would like to say to the membership, the only one thing you have to do is ask yourself one question. Are you better off today than you were two contracts ago? And when you get your ballot, and you'll know at that point who to vote for.
At the end of the day, this election comes down to answering one question, which is, do you want to sell your labor cheap? And my advice to you is, any transit worker who has an interest in selling their labor cheap, they can vote for Barry Roberts and Roger Toussaint because they have a record of doing so. From the 1.5% give back which they voted for, to the fact that transit has money coming in like waves on the seashore, and both of them fail to stand up and demand any of that surplus money. That's not where we want to go. Transit workers cannot afford bad contracts. We've had enough. We've gone backward instead of forward over the last two contracts. It's time for us to move forward. And under my leadership as president of Local 100, I will do everything to continue that fight to ensure that at the end of the day, we get fair wages, fair compensation for the work that we perform because we move New York. Forget about all the feel-good speeches. Just look at the failure in the delivery service we've experienced over the last two contracts. 0-3-3 in 2002. Chronic absenteeism language in the contract that more or less writes you up to terminate you if you use your sick time. You come to 2005, 3% give back, 1.5%. You'll probably do better with a three-card Monty guy. Okay, that's where we are. It's a sad case. It's a sad case when the union leader that you trust would sit down with the employer and the employer says to you, here is 3%, and the president of the union says, I don't think my members deserve 3%. Just give them 3% and I'll get them to give you back 1.5%. And I said no to that. And I stood up there with my colleagues, okay, and we fought against it and we won because transit workers are intelligent enough to recognize that we didn't come here as a hobby. We came here to make money, to take care of our families, and to advance the labor movement. And the president of the union should recognize that he should not have even been here contesting for elections. He should have more or less walked away in shame. Thank you.
That brings to an end this forum, and I would like the entire group assembled here to give all four of these wonderful gentlemen a good hand. This was a positive night for the labor movement in New York City, and I thank all of you for being here. Thank you.